Okay, so thanks to Carol for inviting me to give a talk for PCF for these festival. It's really an honor. There's so many wonderful things going on this week as a part of the festival, so I'm really pleased to be a part of it. I've gotten to that age, I've just realized this morning when I was reading my paper, where I actually should be using bifocals. And I have my contacts in, and one of the biggest challenges I had this morning was figuring out what font size should be for the talk. So I think I've got a good, but if I stumble a little, it's actually because I, was being a little bit vain and putting my contacts rather than wearing my glasses or not wearing anything, which is the only way I can read at the moment. So, okay. So the talk today is really an attempt to talk about a few exhibitions held at the Freud Museum that have a kind of relationship to the Eros show that's on at the moment. Now, the Eros show just went up yesterday, so I haven't had much time to look through it, but I did read the publicity about it, and so I thought I would choose exhibitions that have to do with love, lust, and longing, previous exhibitions. And the ones that I have chosen are, I think, appropriate. Sarah Lucas, Alice Anderson, and Sophie Camp. So I'm going to talk about these. I don't know if everybody knows, but the Freud Museum has been opened in 1986, and from 1989 until recently, it's still ongoing. They've had about 70 contemporary art exhibitions, which is quite a large number of exhibitions, and I think it's one of those secrets of London, but they're really quite magnificent series of exhibitions that included shows by Louise Bourgeois, Sarah Lucas, Sophie Cowell, Matt Collishaw, Alice Anderson, Susan Hiller, Stuart Brisley, just loads and loads of very different kinds of exhibitions. Now, each of the shows engages with the museum in its own way. After all, the Freud Museum is many things. Certainly it is a museum in which the curation, conservation, classification, and preservation of the history and memory of psychoanalysis takes place. However, it also embodies other types of practices. The space of the home, in which the practice of everyday life is undertaken. The consulting room, where psychoanalysis is practiced. The study, where the practices of reading and writing occur. And the gallery, where contemporary art interventions take place. In effect, the Freud Museum is a multi-layered, multi-purpose space with quite an interesting history as well. Because of these multiple layers, I think that there is a great deal of room for maneuvering within it. In that way, I don't think that it's a museum that is what Adorno would say is a dead institution. It's actually a very living institution. And I think that one of the most significant contributions that contemporary art makes to the museum is to live in the museum. It has the ability to create contemporary art exhibitions, alternative worlds for us, different ways of thinking about fourth layer, about psychoanalysis, about the museum, and all of its spaces. Today I'm going to talk about three exhibitions that work alongside the present show. Exhibitions that take up the themes of love, lust, and longing in rather different ways from one another. The first show is by Sarah Lucas, called Beyond the Pleasure Principle, which was exhibited in 2000 and is curated by James Putnam. As one would expect of Lucas, the show puts sex at the forefront of all things associated with passion and desire. I've come to think of the show as the first session of an analysis. Freud and Lucas meeting for the first time. The artist engaging with the analyst through the provocation of the history of her work, charged as it is with the language and imagery of sex. The second show I'm going to look at is Alice Anderson's exhibition Childhood Rituals from 2010, which was curated by Joanna Walker. I've chosen to look at this intervention today, even though it does not seem to be in the first instance about love. Rather, it is on the surface an encounter between a child and her mother based on thwarted desire, turning into a form of fear and perhaps even hate. But upon closer inspection, I think the Anderson exhibition has a lot to tell us about a positive maternal relationship, one that is constructed between the artworks and the figure of Edgar Froid. And that's the second reason why I wanted to talk about the Alice Anderson show. I think it's one of the few interventions in the museum that deals specifically with Anna Freud and her work with children. And the final exhibition that I'm looking at is Sophie Howell's Appointment from 1999. It's one of the earliest shows. And that was curated also by James Hutton. This intervention self-consciously mixes fact and fiction, objects and stories, to create a discontinuous history of the artist's love life, her encounters with various men, as well as her fantasies and desire. Cowell's rather banal personal relics, a wig, a shoe, a painting, a typewriter, a letter, are transfixing when considered in relation to their counterparts. Short, compelling textual accounts of the object, almost forms of confessions, typed onto these seductive pink cards, which offer clues to the object's potency. So, just a little overview, and now I'll start. Sarah Lucas, a first session with Sigmund Freud. The invitation card to the Sarah Lucas show, Beyond the Pleasure Principle, tells it all. That's the image in between. It positions the artist and Sigmund Freud alongside one another. At one end of the invite, there's a portrait of Lucas, smoking a cigarette. She holds the flag gingerly between her downturned lips, neither allowing the growing ash to drop off, nor getting smoke into her squinting eyes. Well, at the opposite, she is wearing a wrinkled black t-shirt, is slouching, defiant, and looking very cool all at the same time. At the opposite end of the card is a portrait of the elderly Freud. He too is smoking, holding a smoldering scar between the fingers and thumb of his right hand. He looks serious with a penetrating gaze. He is in his well-tailored three-piece suit with necktie, silk pocket, cufflinks, and a golden pocket watch, which you only know once you see the full image, actually. He is upright, earnest, and perfectly turned out. In between Lucas and Freud are two chairs. One of Lucas's anthropomorphic bunnies is sitting on a ubiquitous everyday chair. The other is Freud's unique anthropomorphic armchair, the one he used to read and write in at his desk. Empty, it's empty, and waiting, the analyst. The portrait of Freud next to his empty chair suggests that Dr. Freud, the psychoanalyst, is not at his desk, but he's sitting on the analytic couch, smoking and ready to meet his next patient. I can't help but think that this patient is Lucas, with her bunny, who is ready to meet the analyst. The witty challenge posed by the invitation card is to regard the exhibition as a meeting, and perhaps even a confrontation, between Lucas and Freud, Freud and Lucas. This show offers a small and well-selected choice of works that highlight the main aspect of Lucas's practice and her ideas on sex and pleasure. The exhibition originally had its debut at the Sadie Coles Gallery, and then it was transferred to the Freud Museum. And I imagine that there were vastly different readings of the exhibition in these two settings. In the Freud Museum, with its inherent associations with psychoanalysis, this type of overview of Lucas's practice reminds me of the first analytic session. It's important to remember that, as Freud explains, the first session with an analyst, with a new analyst, is the moment wherein the patient is invited to give a brief history of her life. And it is an opportunity for the analyst to begin speaking about herself, and for the analyst to make a decision as to whether the patient would benefit from a psychoanalysis, particularly one with him. Now, the exhibition Beyond the Pleasure Principle, I think, offers just that narrative of Lucas, more specifically, Lucas's artworks and their histories. At the same time, these objects create and evoke references within the Freud Museum. As such, the analytic relationship that has begun is one between works of art and their context, the objects and their site. In a conversation between Sarah Lucas and James Patton about the Freud Museum show, the artist has the following to say about the relationship between her work and herself. So this is Lucas. I've never been that keen to separate the person from the work. In fact, I always wanted making art to be really, really close to myself. Something to do with how you present yourself. And James says, the whole idea of sexuality in your work, that that's not supposed to be personal, is it? And Lucas says, well, it's not autobiographical or confessional, so it's not personal in that way. And Putney responds, so it's portraying yourself as coming across with a certain kind of image or personality, an important part of your work. And Lucas says, yeah, but the real difference is producing this thing, which then is separate from you, which does have its own existence in the world. But that is the only difference. Apart from that, it's the same, a self-conscious activity. I think it's worth pausing over the connection and distinction that Lucas is making as it forms her understanding of what I call autobiographical fiction as a function of her art practice. For the artist, her work is neither autobiographical nor confessional, and she refers to Emily at that point, but it does have a relationship to herself. Making is a self-conscious activity. It is a part of the artist, and it produces something that is also separate from her. Thus, artistic practice is self-conscious and autobiographical, and yet also separate, constructed, fiction. The duality that Lucas is articulating is made visible upon entering Freud's consulting room. It's on the left is one of the works that was in the consulting room. Here we are confronted by an evocative and striking photograph which is situated behind Freud's couch. It is a blown-up image of Lucas's torso, looming suggestively over the divan. She is wearing a well-worn white t-shirt with several opportunely placed ragged holes. Through them we can glimpse her breastbone, a bit of flesh at the curve of her breast, and a seductive peak at her nipple. Self-conscious and autobiographical. This, I'm not stripping. I'm just wondering. Self-conscious and autobiographical, the work is also constructed, a fiction. Headless and handless, the sectional portrait plays with figuring and reconfiguring that which preceded it in Lucas's life, her work, and the history of art. So I'm kind of trying to show in this part of the talk that if we were to imagine that the Lucas show was a first and a first session with a new analyst, then what I'm trying to do is for each of the works that are put in there, I'm trying to give kind of a history for it so that the works become representative of her oeuvre, in a sense, at this point in time in 2000. So I'm talking about the work in the show, but I'm also trying to link it back to create kind of a personal history of artistic practice, let's say. So entitled Prière de Toucher, that's the Lucas work, which means please touch. The photograph is named after Marcel Duchamp's cover for the limited edition exhibition catalogue, which accompanied the first post-war surrealist art exhibition to be staged in Paris in 1947, which is on the right. In Duchamp's work, a foam rubber breast, hand-painted, including a detailed nipple, is secured onto a ragged piece of black velvet that is glued onto cardboard. The artwork is then affixed onto the front cover of the catalogue. Claire Bishop, the art critic, has called the Duchamp work a decadently chauvinistic gesture, which she sees as being complicated by this Lucas work, potent and fascinating image in its own right. This duality brings to mind a conversation Luke had with the British journalist Lynn Barber, where the artist explained, I was quite a tomboy when I was growing up. I liked hanging out with a lot of boys, and I sort of got used to their way of talking about sex. And at the same time, I was thinking it was funny. I suppose I was a bit aware that it also applied to me. And I've always had those two attitudes. I did enjoy it, but at the same time, I must have shuddered inwardly, I think. It stayed with me anyway, didn't it? And then eventually, Lucas is talking about all of the different things that she was reading at the time. And she said, she tells Lynn Barber that she came across Andrew Dworkin, who is an American feminist. And she says of the Dworkin, it was a bit like I imagine it must have been for people at one time reading Karl Marx. In some ways, it was quite quite destructive. I remember going through a bad patch with my boyfriend because it had an effect on our sexual relations, making me self-conscious and angry. Or maybe it was something going on in the relationship and it was just a handy bit of ammunition to have read the Dworkin. Lucas's Pierre du Touché, like her first self-portrait, Eating a Banana, which I'm sure you all know, and the others that followed, many of which are combined in the work Self-Portraits, which the image on the far right is actually a photograph of the work Self-Portraits, where she combines all of her self-portraits from 1990 to 1998, speaks to this described this duality in Lucas's work between, you know, being one of the lads and having fun with it, but also realizing that this was actually about her as well. On the one hand, the portrait above Freud's couch, which is to the right, the Lucas portrait above Freud's couch invites us to please touch, rehearses the male gaze that she appropriates as one of the lads, and consciously and courageously positions it onto herself. It also references and lays open the function of the photograph that usually hangs above Freud's couch, which is the one on the right, the lithograph of a painting by André Breuillet of Freud's mentor Charcot, teaching his colleagues about female hysteria as one of his patients, Marie Whitman, known as Blanche, swoons for the audience. The male gaze penetrates and touches the female body. On the one hand, the Lucas photograph evokes a startling self-consciousness in the constraint of the arms behind her back, in the upright position of the torso, in the nipple refusing to get out of your face. In viewing the photograph, it is difficult not to feel the oscillation, the contradiction. Across from Pierre du Touché, you can now see a larger photograph here, is a version of Lucas's bunnies. This one is called Hysterical Attack Mouths, a perfectly reasonable sculpture to find in Freud's consulting room. A second work, Historical Attack's Eyes, on the right, is just around the corner in Freud's library. And in front of the and it sits in front of the display's Charcot image. So she's moved it and put it there. The titles of these two sculptures allude to Freud's work with female hysterics. The lithograph of Charcot and reference and revisit some of Lucas's previous work. For instance, the tentacles, limbs, felt an octopus, and big fat anarchic spider initiate the artist's use of anthropomorphic forms, while the bunnies from 1997 introduce the headless, torsoless, legged figures that later became the papier-mâché Love Me, which is on the bottom, complete with eyes and mouths. What I'm getting at here is the way in which the work in the Freud Museum show refers back to Lucas's previous work. Thereby functioning as a sort of summary of oneself that is part and parcel of the first analytic session with the new psychoanalyst. I imagine Freud likes what he hears and asks Lucas to continue. In the Freud family's dining room resides the pleasure principle. Two figures fucking, one male, one female. She, one of the Freud family's dining chairs, wears a white bra and matching panties. The bra is filled with two big globe light bulbs. He, another chair, wears a white vest and wide fronts. She is placed on top of the oak dining table. He is on the wooden floor. A strip of leg coming out of the wide front and, inserted beneath the panties connects them. Adrian Soke comments that if there were voices speaking in this installation, they would say something like, "Let's do it on the table," one half of the work seems to say. "Don't push me on a pedestal," the other half says. "It is all very rambunctious and absurd," says Searle. "All that striving, all that posing, all that getting it up and getting it down." He concludes that through Lucas's work, we come to notice that the language of sex and the language of sculpture aren't so different. It is all about mistaking one object for another. Although Lucas thinks of herself as squeamish and sex not something she could really talk about, from her work, sex seems to always be on Lucas's mind. The use of chairs and objects as a shorthand for the human figure reaches back to The Old Couple in 1991. Those are the two, the one on the left and the one in the middle. Or Bitch from 1995. For the writer Rachel Le Goff, Lucas's The Pleasure Principle brings to mind something Freud wrote. We have all experienced how the greatest, this is Freud, we have all experienced how the greatest pleasure attainable by us, that of the sexual act, is associated with a momentary extinction of a highly intensified excitation. That's the end quote. Le Goff surmises that this would have been a good quote to place next to Lucas's piece, with a switch inviting the viewer to turn off the power and extinguish the hot white tube of sexual heat. For without the throbbing tube, the piece would look rather banal. And the session goes on. This is the final piece in the show. Upstairs, in what was once Sigmund and Anna Freud's bedroom. I did that this morning when I was reading this title. Okay. Sigmund and Martha Freud's bedroom, which is the exhibition room. Okay. Next to one of their small tables. And this was Anna's bedroom. Oh, Anna. Just forgive me. Okay. There is the installation Beyond the Pleasure Principle. A red futon mattress is suspended from a garment rail. A neon tube, a penis, dick, pierces the mattress while two globe lights, scrotum, bollocks, are wrapped around it. The tube juts out towards the back of a rusty metal bucket. Bottom ass. Inside the bucket is a single orange ball, vagina, cunt. Above it, a wire coat hanger has two small white light bulbs, breast, tits, tentatively secured below it. The work seems to say sex, life, and pleasure. Yet part of the mattress is laid out upon a white cardboard coffin. And it's hard to see. I didn't find it's right there. And it's quite difficult. There aren't very many good images of the show. And with this white box, we are reminded of death and its drive. The allusion to Freud's 1920 work Beyond the Pleasure Principle is here, literally. But as the art historian Brian Furr remarks, the artworks in the show do not function as vehicles for Freud's work. And this is Brian. Lucas's objects are evacuated of the storytelling drive which surround them at the same time as they are so heavily laden with them that the place is full of their innuendo. I agree. The Freudian narrative is not here and yet implied everywhere. This work behaves much like the others in the show. It refers back to Lucas's previous work, telling a story that is both autobiographical and fictitious. There's reference to the early work from 1994, Au Naturel, that speaks of sex, the dirty yellow mattress, the two small oranges, an upright cucumber, the medium-sized melons and metal bucket. Only a few years later, in 1997, cardboard coffins and neon lights flicker in cosmic dream texture. We know that Lucas thinks of her practice as the same as herself, a self-conscious activity. That's what she said earlier, what I quoted earlier on. While also different from herself. In this autobiographical framework, it is clear that this intervention rehearses, reconfigures, recontextualizes, and renews the meaning of earlier work. It is a summary, a renewed narrative about previous work. In the context of the Freud Museum, the exhibition constitutes, what I think it does, an initial story that a patient might tell her analyst in their first session. A fictional narrative made up of female body parts, male body parts, sex, death, pleasure, and displeasure. Time is up. The first session has come to an end. Okay. Alice Anderson, opening up to Anna Freud. I'm going to begin with a quote from Alice Anderson. Before I do that, that's a picture of Anna Freud on the right, and the one on the left is of the artist Alice Anderson, and she's with her doll, and the doll is a wax doll of herself. It's an exact duplicate of herself.
And what's important to know at this point is the red hair. So this is Alice Henderson. The red doll's hair has great personal significance related to childhood memories. She says, I remember the terrible fears I used to have when I was a child, left alone at home for many long hours, waiting for the return of my mother. At that time, I invented rituals for myself to calm my anxieties. For example, these rituals consisted of undoing the thread from seams, and I would wind these threads around parts of my body and other objects. Later, I began to use hair instead of thread, her own hair. In this emotionally charged personal avowal, the artist Alice Henderson acknowledges her ubiquitous use of red doll's hair within her practice, the color of which is the exact same as her own, and the relationship her work has to the maternal figure. Focusing on the artworks in this show, as well as the curatorial decisions made by Joanna Walker in conversation with Alice Henderson, I'd like to approach this show as a means of thinking about a daughter's ongoing examination of her relationship to her mother, an examination that evokes the figure of Anna Freud. The show begins with the Freud Museum itself. The house is all tied up. 3,000 bobbins of red doll's hair have been gathered together by Anderson and her crew of technical assistants, twisted into skeins and lassoed around the home of the Freud family to form Housebound. The skeins crisscross the architectural structure, run across the facade, over windows, and wrap around chimneys. The red hair is finally gathered, twisted further, knotted, and anchored into the earth. Shot of the anchoring. The Freud Museum is rendered useless, while at the same time the robes emphasize its form, its existence, its history, and yes, its continued use, as, of course, visitors are still allowed to knock on the door and walk into the museum, and thus enter this tied-up object. Upon entering Sigmund Freud's study, this is a shot of the study and consulting room from the Alice Henderson show, we realize that it is darker than usual. The lights have been dimmed. Slowly approaching the consulting room and desk, one notices that a fine web of red hair now veils the space. I don't know if you can see it. You can see it a little bit there. It's really amazing, amazing thing. It's kind of, you're quite taken aback by it because you're used to going further in to the room, and then you notice this web. And you're stopped in your tracks. Visual access has been impaired and physical admission to the psychoanalyst's lair has been restricted by Webb. We have been barred from the father. As Anderson puts it, Webb was a means of displacing the heavy shadow of Sigmund Freud, the masculine and authoritarian within the museum, who is now present, because he's always present downstairs in the museum, but he's been barred. Moving into the dining room, I quickly noticed that it's been stripped down to its bare essentials. This I thought was quite shocking. They did this also for the Louise Bourgeois show. Furniture has been removed, chairs, paintings, portraits, and other objects have been put into storage. It is as though an attempt has been made to turn an historical museum into a white cube gallery. Within the newly configured space, artworks reference what has been displaced. For instance, there's a short 2-minute video of a performance entitled Butterfly, which shows Anderson reenacting the rituals she remembers repeating as a child. She winds and unwinds rips of doll's hair on her fingers until they go black and blue, and then she unwinds them. Okay. There are several other objects placed carefully in the dining room. There are power figures and asleep, including a whip made of hair. You can hardly see it, but this is a whip made of hair. This is parents, and this is one of the power figures. These are two little balls, which he calls capsules, of this hair, and they have this thin tie together, a thin string that connects them. The both terrifying and protective figures, the room vibrates with images of power. As Anderson has said, in the mother-daughter relationship, there aren't two actors, but three. Power is the third element. The figures are tied up, immobile, unable to grow. A whip is at hand. But like the work done by Freud's... they are remade into works of art, producing a form of pleasure. The objects in the dining room are intersubjective. This is a word that Jessica Benjamin, who is an American psychoanalyst, uses to talk about the relationship between the analyst and analysand. And I think that Alice Anderson's show really evokes the idea of intersubjectivity, particularly the relationship between parent and child, mother and child. For instance, the two cocoons of hair, child and parent, on the table are separate yet connected, touching one another through a thin skein of hair suggests the potential, if not reality, of a more positive experience of intersubjectivity. Having been borrowed from the father downstairs, I wonder what will be found upstairs in the space that was Martha and Sigmund Freud's bedroom, the exhibition room. Another attempt has been made to transform the room into a white cube. It is cleared of almost everything. At the center of the space is a rather powerful sculpture. A wax doll of a little girl is confined within a wooden structure. She is wearing a red and blue dress with white tights and black banded shoes. She is the spitting image of the artist. This is confinement room. Those are images. In interviews with the artist, the story of the doll's emergence is repeated and thus worth recounting in full. It functions as a confession. So this is what Alice Anderson says about the making of this particular doll. When I decided to make a replica of myself, I contacted Madame Tussauds, and a sculptor, Lydia Turco, came to work at my studio every day for 2 months. During the work sessions, I couldn't move, and we talked about very private matters, even though I hardly knew her. We established a very strange relationship between us. Looking back, I think the doll witnessed a kind of psychoanalytic session. The more I talked, the more the doll grew. I remember being very sick at the time, while the doll got stronger and stronger. Later, she became a sort of guardian, my invigilator. And then, little by little, I felt threatened by its presence. I put her in a coffin in an exhibition because I was trying to free myself from her influence. I committed an act of violence against my replica, but I didn't choose to just put her in a closet and forget her. On the contrary, I put her in the center, exhibiting her like a precious object. I'm protecting her. Rather than in a glass coffin, the doll at the Ford Museum is in a box-like structure, not unlike a child's playpen, but with railings made of red hair and placed upon four high metal stilts. Here, too, she's confined as well as protected. Confined and protected, another paradox of the mother-daughter bond. Once again, power is the third term, as the doll that Anderson thinks of as alive yet animate remains seated, restricted, and immobile. While coming to terms with her situation, that's the doll situation, I became aware, this time from inside of the house, of the large skeins of hair wrapped around the house, and that's why I put in that shot on the top right. I could see them hanging across the windows of the bedroom and reflect upon the many layers and ways in which we are both confined and protected in our lives. And this is the last room. In the Anna Freud room, there is a second wax doll, a replica and alter ego of the artist, seated at the psychoanalyst loom. This was the installation of the Anna Freud room, although it was Martha Burlingham's, let me not do that, before it's changed, before it's been reconfigured. So at one time, maybe, I don't know, 7 months ago, is that right, up until 7 months ago, it had Anna Freud's loom, as well as her consulting, her couch and her chair, and one of the tables is still there, and some of the cupboards are still there as well. So it was quite a different space before when the Anderson show was up. Okay, so we now find another, a replica doll, the alter ego of the artist, seated at the psychoanalyst's loom. She's bigger than the first doll, dressed differently in a light pink full-length dress and gold shoes. She's called Mother Doll. This doll is seemingly unrestricted, although ultimately she too, of course, is confined within the house. Mother Doll weaves from the large bundles of red hair capsules that are placed all over the room. These are capsules, and these were all over the exhibition in various places. The doll uses them to weave, to reconstruct, to remake, to unwind and rewind what has already been worked within becoming capsules. The hair is continually in a process of becoming. In this instance, the larger doll is making a grid, similar to the ones that confine and protect the smaller doll in the other room. Unlike the other rooms that have been stripped back of the museum's furniture, in this room, everything remains present. Anna Freud's room, with its analytic couch and chair, her loom, her library, some of her library, and work table, forms the center of Alice Anderson's childhood rituals. In contrast to Sigmund Freud's consulting room and study, we can enter fully into Anna Freud's workspace in this show. We can stand very near to the loom, the doll, and the capsules. We are part of the installation, other than spectators. Being in this room and thinking across it and the bedroom where the child resides, I'm prompted to think about intersubjectivity, feminine-to-feminine relationships, female-to-female relationships, daughter-mother relationships, mother-daughter, daughter-daughter, and daughter-analyst. I begin with a rather harsh interpretation of the mother-daughter relationship in the show. The mother weaves the grids that confine the daughter. But perhaps there is something else happening here as well. I begin to consider whether there is a positive feminine figure of transformation here. And I came to think that Anna Freud was actually this figure. Standing in the Anna Freud room, thinking of her ideas on childhood and engaging with these two dolls, I wonder if it is possible to consider the artwork transformative. What if by representing the mother of the loom, the daughter is narrating and fictionalizing the mother? And by representing the mother as a replica of the daughter at the loom, the daughter also narrates herself. At one and the same time, mother and daughter, the figure at the loom takes action. She's weaving, creating a grid that protects as much as it confines. The loom, importantly, is Anna Freud's loom. In itself it is representative of psychoanalysis and promises action and productivity. We know that for Sigmund Freud, weaving was a feminine mode of concealing penis envy and genital deficiency. However, we also know from Elizabeth Young Brill's biography of Anna Freud that she was taught to knit by her nanny Josephine in order that she may participate in the family's knitting circle, which was headed by her aunt Minna, her mom's sister. Later in life, Anna Freud told her friend and colleague, Mam Friedman, that when I was a little girl and had a new knitting project, I had to start it at once. I have not lost that enthusiasm. My mother tried to moderate this habit, but she was not successful. I am still the same. Freud notes, Freud also tried to moderate what he called Anna's passionate excesses. But his entreaties resulted in a conversion from knitting to weaving. So Anna just kept on going. Anna Freud... I think the other thing that I want to say, rather than reading it, I just want to say that the other interesting thing about Anna Freud and her knitting and her weaving, she also made her own clothes throughout her life. She had this passion for sewing, clearly. She also designed some clothes with a friend of hers, and they sold them together. They had their own label. And I guess another interesting thing to know is that she knitted during her psychoanalytic sessions. And she jokingly says to her niece, it would, after all, not be practical to use a sewing machine when I was seeing patients, so she knitted instead. Okay. So it was an integral part of her practice as a psychoanalyst. That's what I wanted to put in place. Seated at the loom, weaving, Anderson's mother-daughter figure provokes certain associations with Anna Freud, her compassion, her productivity, her leisure, her maternal temperament, and her analytic skills. That's Anna Freud's. In a sense, then, Anna Freud comes to represent for this mother-daughter figure a surrogate mother and psychoanalyst. Anna Freud, who had no biological or adopted children, had an enormous family of children. Whether it was through her life with Dorothy Burlingham and Dorothy's children, or through her work as a child's therapist, Anna Freud was surrounded by children whom she mothered. While walking in between Anna's room and her parents' bedroom, one wonders what these two dolls, daughter and mother, mother and daughter, confined and yet active, ultimately speak of. As replicas of a daughter playing both roles, it becomes possible to think of their relationship as a barring of the father and an encounter with the life and work of Anna Freud, an encounter based on repetition. Of the daughter-mother weaving grids, working through and organizing the skeins of her autobiography that confined her, rebuilding these memories into something usable. Okay, now the Sophie Cal is much shorter in the section. So, Sophie Cal, a love letter to Freud. Freud once said that transference is a new edition of an old object. The old object of our conscious fantasies and wishes is made new when it is transferred onto our relationship with our analyst. Is this what happens when Sophie Cal's old work, and by that I'm very specifically talking about work that has been shown elsewhere. It's really important to know that almost all of the exhibitions that take place here of contemporary art are based on objects that have been made beforehand. Have been shown elsewhere, mainly in white cubes, and then come here. So some artists actually make things on site and make things for the show, but the vast majority of them have this kind of transposition. So is this what happens when Sophie Cal's old work is transferred into this new context, specifically when previously made and exhibited works have an appointment with Freud? So the gesture here is that the Sophie Cal show is actually a show given to and animated by the sense of a positive transference onto Freud, this love letter to Freud. And they're small, but they're okay. I'm giving you shots of various little installations in the show. In the entrance hall, a blonde wig that Cal once used for strip-teasing adorns the Freud family's coffee table. The artist's wedding dress rests on Sigmund Freud's couch, a memento of Cal's youthful infatuation with an older man who she eventually has sex with 30 years later. While a man's bathrobe, the artist's father had the same bathrobe, became her first lover at the age of 18, that bathrobe is draped onto one of Freud's chairs. Placed next to several of Freud's phallic figures is one of Cal's pithy narratives, this time recounting Cal's wedding night, an evening and narrative that ends with, and this is Cal, she had these little pink cards next to all of the installations that have these wonderful, wonderful little paragraphs, wonderful little anecdotes that really enliven the little installation. So the one with the erection, this one, it ends with, "An erection was the first thing that marriage had given me." Situated on the side table decorating the upper landing is a photograph of Cal's fake wedding next to the image of Martha and Sigmund Freud's nuptials, and that is this one. And Anna Freud's work table, this one, is the typewriter with two love letters. One love letter that Sophie Cal came across, which her boyfriend had written to his other lover, and one love letter that Sophie Cal paid someone to write to her. Together, these objects and texts form a kind of love letter to Freud, a positive transference to the site and one of its inhabitants. So this is just a selection. I think there are 15 different installations. Interventions, actually. Cal's personal objects and private narratives recount tales of love, sex, lust, pain, sadness, concrete fear, humor, penis envy, and disappointment. moving from one object and narrative to the next, accumulating knowledge of this ethnographer of everyday life, whose subject is Cal herself, the interloper becomes riveted and discomforted by what unfolds in front of and within herself. Each intervention feeds one's desire to simultaneously know more and the discomfort of being told and knowing any of it at all. It's kind of like you're gripped by reading them and you're thinking, oh God, why are you telling me this? Too much information. Unable to perform the role of the non-sympathetic, non-judgmental psychoanalyst, which I think is a part of what happens when this installation is put into the Freud Museum, there remains an awareness of a sort of transference taking place from object and artist to viewer and sight. I'm going to just speak this bit very quickly. Freud wrote about transference throughout his career, and his ideas around it changed, like most of Freud's ideas. And transference, his thinking around transference changed because of the clinical work that he did. So it's hard to pinpoint how his definition of transference, because it is kind of a working definition. But one of the things that he did continue to believe is that transference is the most difficult moment of resistance within a psychoanalysis, and also what needs to be worked through with the analyst and needs to be interpreted in order for the cure to take place. This kind of projection of your unconscious fantasies and desires onto your analyst needs to be interpreted and translated. What is most striking about Cal's appointment is her use of narratives. In these rather effective histories placed next to her and Freud's object, Cal uses a very flat, descriptive, non-analytical, and non-interpretive language. And we know that Cal spends a lot of time working and reworking these texts in order to come up with these kinds of stories and for them to function in this sort of way, where they have all of the accoutrements of bourgeois language, but then they're also completely undermined with what she's talking about. And Robert Storr, the curator and critic of Robert Storr, says that this is a lot like what happens with Freud's work, or what happened with Freud's work, where he was giving lectures in a very proper way about things that the bourgeoisie at that point found improper to talk about. Last quote from Cal. She's asked, what is your relationship to the false and the real? Because when you're in this exhibition and you're reading these things, you think, of course, that it's Cal herself, because part of it is Cal. And she says, everything is real. Everything is true in the works. There's just generally one lie included. But the lie is related to a frustration. So every time there is a lie, and generally there is only one in each work, it is what I have liked to find and didn't find. So Cal makes it abundantly clear that in her work one never knows what is real and which is the lie. And this is my conclusion. This is a quote by Adam Phillips. He says, those who want to continue misleading themselves about the past write autobiographies. And I think of these particular exhibitions as autobiographical. Autobiographical fictions, I think of them. Those who want to know themselves and their history have psychoanalysis. I know, bless him. But he goes on to totally, unravel this. But anyway, I think I'm going to stop there. Thank you.
I'm a bit conscious of time, so I know some people are here for now. So I think, yes, we might ask Janine just to say a few words as an introduction to the current exhibition.
And then this is my chair now. I get to sit in the chair.
And then, obviously, some people may not be able to stay any longer, but if there are those who want to stay, we could have a bit of a discussion and question and answer session after your... Thank you.
Thank you very much for that illuminating talk. And I should say that while I have curated the exhibition, I didn't curate the contemporary section of the current show with four contemporary artists. That was Carol Siegel, Sophie Layton, and Bryony Davies. I wrote a book about Freud's art collection called The Gods of Freud, and it was a wonderful experience for me, really immersing myself in the collection and immersing myself in being here in the museum. I've been a regular visitor now through the Freud Museum since 2002, and I am not a psychoanalyst, and I promiscuously engage with both Freudian and Lacanian views about psychoanalysis and enjoy both of them. Though I found it was very handy that I had been in a psychoanalysis, because the first thing people asked me about when I began writing the book was, you know, have you been in analysis? And thankfully, due to my grandmother's death and the awful depression I went through afterwards, I could say yes. Yes, I have. So I have read Freud, you know, from quite a sort of amateur point of view, so I didn't bring a lot of frames, you know, to my research on Freud. And I, of course, had read Interpretation of Dreams. I was not so hostile, even though as a feminist, to a lot of his theories. You know, I thought he had a lot of fantastically liberating and dynamic ideas about sex and sexuality. Where he got the idea of penis envy from, I don't know. It was one of his dumbest ideas, you know. Not terribly interesting, totally untrue. I'd like to have a conversation with him about one of these days. But the notion of Eros I found fascinating because one of the, you know, Freud really understood, and he took his cues from Plato and Plato's Symposium in Classical Civilization, this notion of Eros being, you know, a very turbulent, and it's an ancient idea, comes from Hesiod's Theogony, that when Eros arises, you know, procreation begins, you know, reproduction begins, sexuality begins, turbulence, the violence of passion and love, it all begins there. But this notion of love is situated very much around desire, you know, as Plato says in the Symposium, desire is what you want, what you can't have, you know, desire is always absence, you know. And I think Freud understood that very well. And to me, his collection, in fact, is a representation of desire. He can never have enough objects. He kept having to have more objects, you know, as he said to Jung, I must always have an object to love. And one of the main inspirations behind this particular exhibition was a key work, which you'll see in the show. It's number one, this beautiful, this magnificent statue of Eros, probably from Myrina, about 150 BC. And on this Acropolis, the French school of Athens dug up about 4,000 tombs, came up with these absolutely brilliant, you know, antiquities, some of which found their way to the Louvre. It was interesting going to the Louvre and seeing Freud's Eroses, they were better. You know, he had better examples. So, you know, he was a brilliant mind, a psychoanalyst who was so engaged with notions of love and sexuality. And always I think there's that tragic side to what how Freud sees love and sex playing out. There's always a dark side. There's always a disappointment. There's loss, you know. This is why Freud is always so wonderful writing about grief and mourning and melancholia. And even within the notion of Eros, it comes this idea of turbulence and passion, unsatisfied passion, desperate, mad, crazy love, you know, love that hurts you, love that takes you by surprise. And the Greeks understood this very well. This was initially their idea of Eros. You know, it smashed its way into your life. But on from that, what that can lead to, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to include Martha Bernays' letters to Freud during their long courtship. They exchanged thousands of letters because we don't often hear Martha's voice. So who was she? You know, who was this woman? And Freud fell passionately, madly in love with this woman, as you'll read from his letters. I mean, he really did understand Eros very well. He understood the pain and the longing of love, as well as he understood being possessed and wishing to possess. And also he had other beautiful objects in his collection like the phallus amulets, which you're going to have a lot of difficulty looking at without falling over laughing. They had no erotic connections in their own time. They were good luck charms, and they were meant to avert evil or the evil eye or envy. You sewed them into your clothes. And this to me relates to Freud's own attitude, you know, to the genitals. And he says, you know, once upon a time, of course, in previous civilizations like ancient Greece, you know, the penis or vulva. There's a marvellous little statue of a goddess called Balbo, who's lying with her legs spread, pointing to her vulva, smiling, you know. The genitals were regarded as objects of worship. They were sacred, you know. They were sacred things. And today we realise how prurient we are in our so-called, you know, racy, pacey 21st century society. We wouldn't go around, you know, sort of sewing penises into our clothes without expecting some sort of hostile reaction from sort of people around us wondering what on earth we were doing this for. So these were some of the sort of generative, formative kind of concepts behind developing Freud and Eros. And I'm delighted. I've, you know, always been aware of contemporary art in the house, you know, in the museum, and it's wonderful that a book is now going to be written about that, because I think it contextualises Freud's collection further, and it contextualises his own aesthetic ambitions, his own aesthetic adventure, which is represented in the collection. And I think it's by bringing the works out and isolating them, taking them out of their sort of 19th century crowded museum aesthetic, which was Freud's, and putting them into our sort of modernist, you know, white cube, white gallery, focally lit, lots of space around them, into that aesthetic, I think we also begin to see another layer, which is, you know, what high aesthetic standards Freud had, and what a brilliant collector of brilliant objects he was.
Thank you. Well, I think it's great. I think it's a wonderful introduction to actually go and see Freud and Eros, Love, Lust and Longing, which is the works that Janine's been talking about are in the exhibition room on this floor, and the artworks are on the ground floor. If people have to go, then obviously, you know, feel free to do so. But if those would like to stay and have ask some questions, have a discussion, I think we've got, you know, another 10 minutes, an hour, if people would like to do that. So, but thanks to both Joe and to Janine as well.